And welcome to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. I'm Dan Miller, and we are very excited today to be joined by one of Canada's best-known waterfowl guides, Claudio Anguero. He's the host of the very popular show Hired to Hunt. It's my favorite show by far, and I'm super excited that he's been willing to join us today. Claudio, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, and thanks a lot. Great to be here. So it's one of those rainy, snowy days in central Alberta, and it's a good day to be in the office, you know?
Yeah, I have to say it's a little weird to think about snow in May. I was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and then I just moved down to Green Bay, and so I was used to snow at this point, but, Green Bay, we're sunny and 50 degrees and not right. A cloud in the sky. So are you guys still hunting up there?
We are. We did a couple hunts, in fact, and a buddy of mine just texted me, another outfitter that I've known for, 30 years. They went out with a couple of buddies. They shot 71 or 72 snows last night, which was good. And, it was good. They had good, great conditions for them in the afternoon, and they whacked them pretty good.
Are you guys still booking a lot of trips, or do you take the spring season to kind of hunt for yourselves at all?
No, of course, I had a bunch of hunters booked from that April 10th right to about May 5th or so. I think I had just about the full month booked, and I take mostly, U.S. Residents. But with this COVID thing, we had to we shut down. I mean, when you're running a full service deal where we're at the lodge and you're in close proximity to people, and with the borders being closed, we shut down. There's some of the other outfitters that will run resident hunters, and they're still active and chasing them, but my program's a little different. I mean, we're at the lodge and we got, 5 or 10 guys and all the staff. It's not conducive to the environment we're in right now with this pandemic,
Yeah, I suppose the borders being shut down wouldn't be very good for U.S. business.
No, unfortunately, no. But hopefully it opens up, come September, because that can be quite alarming, especially for all outfitters and, internationally, really. I mean, if this doesn't open up, it could definitely hurt a lot of outfitters, a lot of hunting, especially future of hunting too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, I mean, you guys open up what, September 1st, September 15th, something like that?
Yeah, we're open September 1st. Yep. We just go right till December 15th where we're at. But, by November 4th or 5th, we're tired, tattered and torn, and it's time to pack it in and go deer hunting,
So tell us a little bit about what Anguero's is. Obviously, it's a huge operation. Some people may just see the waterfowl side of things and not even realize kind of the scope of it. So tell us a little bit about the lodge, about your guide service, about the history of it, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really huge. I mean, I'm a fairly prolific outfitter. I mean, I woke up one day, I was 27 years old. My dad was sick. He had cancer. I used to be a teacher. And I went, I want to build a hunting lodge. And I remember, going back even further to when I was, 17, you're sitting there in the library at high school, you're supposed to be studying and you're flipping through Outdoor Life magazine. You see these, Canadian hunting lodges. And I went, I want to be one of those guys, and so, put that aside for 10 years, ended up becoming a teacher. And then, my dad was sick and I thought, I want to take some, half a year off teaching, do a couple months of hunting, spend the rest of the year with my dad. And I did that for 2 years. And then, unfortunately, my dad passed away in 95. And, my first year was 1994, and I built the lodge in spring of 95. And, there's been no looking back. And, I just do a 9-week window where we run our hunters through there, and then fast forward another 20 years, and I partnered up with another guy in a Saskatchewan lodge, and Gerald Gilbert and I, run and own and operate that. Now, obviously, he handles that one, and I run and operate mine. And then, 7 years ago, the show came about. We just decided to, hey, we do a lot of fun, crazy stuff. And, of course, I had a partner in the show, and she goes, well, that's great. And most of the fun and crazy stuff we can't really put on TV. So, So, yeah, HBO would have been more appropriate than some of the hunting channels. But anyways, you know, we came up with a show that fit, and, you know, here we are today. And, you know, with this COVID thing just recently, you know, I got stuck in my office, and, you know, I always had this vision of kind of changing the way we hunt a little bit, and I came out with some other stuff, some new camo and some, you know, some decoy wear where we're just kind of dressed as, you know, waterfowl in your spread instead of, you know, actually laying in a blind. And we do that with white suits with some of the birds. So, you know, we tested it this spring and it worked, and we'll test more of it this fall. And here we are. That's it.
You know, I think you get the, you still get the teacher vibe in the show, because you guys are always explaining stuff. It's not just a show of just, you know, birds falling out of the sky and that's it. I mean, it's every aspect of the hunt, from picking the guys up from the airport to the meals to the setting up the decoys and spotting the hunts and everything. I mean, I think that's my favorite part about the show, is it feels a lot more realistic.
Well, you know, when I started the show, first of all, you know, and the show host, I mean, it's tough. I mean, having a TV show just is expensive, it's costly, there's a lot of administration. But if you're a TV show host that's traveling, well, you have to contact all of these outfitters, make arrangements to go there. Camera crews are expensive, travel's expensive, flights are expensive. So you're really working on a skeleton budget all the time when you're traveling to all these destinations, right? And, of course, in our situation, we're there for 63 days. I bring the camera crew in. We're not flying anybody around. We just have to basically can the information that we have. I mean, it's still expensive. But, you know, if a cameraman films for 3 days without filming a hunt, well, it's all factored into that whole, you know, the contract that we have with the camera guys. So it just lends itself to compiling a whole bunch of other, what I would consider very relevant information. And you can never stop learning. I mean, the game changes all the time. I mean, you know, in 1994, I thought I was good at bird hunting. And I'll tell you what I learned real quick, how bad I was at bird hunting, you know, and I've carried that forward to this day, you know, and I think we do a really good job. Do I think there's a whole lot more to learn? Hell yeah. There's a lot more to learn, like lots, you know, and it never ends. You know, like this spring, for example, we went out and Daryl and Emily and I, and Daryl's our partner in Saskatchewan, Emily, our first hunt, 150 for three of us, snow geese, all dancing on your toes. The 2 days later, the three of us shot 76, different pot of birds, different reaction, right? All of them were shot 45 yards to 50 yards up. A couple did the dance in front of us. And then hunted with two other outfitters. You know, we got three guys, know what we're doing. We can all shoot somewhat. We actually hired one of the guides to spot for us as well. And we come out of there one day with 22 and one day with 27 or something like that. So still good, but not the epic hunt we expected, right? So you can always learn. You can always tweak.
Yeah, and there's nothing to make you humble like snow geese.
Oh, or everything, you know, like even mallards. I can relate one example, and that's why, you know, me and the guides, when we're spotting, you watch us on the show, and we're all so paranoid, right? Like, there's so much that can go wrong. And, you know, I took a group of hunters out at 3,500 mallards, maybe more, feeding in a pot. Well, not feeding in a puddle. They hit the puddle. There's a little part in the cattails where they walked out. They fed in the peas. Like, we're talking several acres of birds in, I mean, it was a 1,200 acre pea field, but they are pounding that pothole. And I watched them for 3 days. Said, okay, guys, let's go in there at 1 o'clock. And it was kind of snotty weather in the morning, rainy, cloudy. And I said, let's go in there early. You know, I kicked out 3,500 mallards when we went in there to set up. We come out of there with six. You know, they didn't come back to feed. And when they came back to have a look, it was, even if I would have been set up in the field, it was after the eagle when they came back. You tell me why they did that on that given afternoon.
Because they're waterfowl.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, if there's one thing I learned, I've learned how little I know, and we put a lot of birds on that deck, and it's amazing how much you can learn, you know?
Yeah, and what's that pressure like? I mean, these guys that have come to you, they've obviously paid a fair amount of money. They've traveled typically internationally. This is a trip of their lifetime. What's that pressure like on you and your guides to put together that perfect hunt?
Well, it's huge pressure. And, you know, the pressure doesn't really come from the clients, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, it did when I was younger, you know, when you're trying to prove yourself as an outfitter. Now we have such a, you know, long history. And, I mean, I could give you stats on every 3 days what we've killed going back 20 years. So, you know, and I would go, well, this is the worst hunt we've had in 20 years. The chances of it being worse than this are kind of unlikely. And this is the best hunt we've had in 20 years. Unlikely that you're going to have a hunt better than this, you know. And I'm talking kill. Like, let's say we killed 325 for 10 guys in 2.5 days. And our best hunt, we whacked a bunch of snows, we killed 1,107. Like, that's a strong 2.5 day hunt. And there's the spectrum, right? And it's usually going to land somewhere in between. The pressure we put on ourselves, because it's the integrity and the one underlying factor why we do this, is that drive back to the lodge, for whether it's a 4 minute drive or a 45 minute drive with a hunt that went sideways. It just isn't fun. It's not that the hunters aren't sad or mad, but they've had a long day, they're tired, and they don't have that jazz in them to talk about all the great shots they made, or, oh, look at how those birds decoyed. Remember that one that just flooded over our head? And it just becomes this long drive that's quiet, and you're sitting there self-reflecting on what could I have done differently, and that's the worst feeling. And that's what drives us it's like that's the punishment that you get that you don't want to have to go through. So you make sure you do your spotting and you've got your game on all the time. And, of course, sometimes, like I mentioned about the six ducks, it's going to happen, but you just don't know when it's going to happen, you know. But
yeah, so, that makes sense.
Yeah, the pressure, you know. And now, I mean, so I've had some hunters, they've been with me since 95. Like, I mean, we're talking 22 years. You know, they come up, we take one on the chin, they go, yeah, Claudia, don't worry about it. You know, we don't like it. They understand it because they are traveling hunters, you know. And for the most part, though, even the guys who save their entire life to come and make a trip, it's a pretty good bet. I mean, and I tell these guys, you know, you're going to get very well taken care of. The hunting's going to be at worst this, at best this. Let's pray for something to land in between. And, you know, even our worst hunt is better than, you know, most hunting and, you know, waterfowl hunting in North America anyway. So it's pretty strong.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is that like a confidential trade secret, what your worst hunt is?
What? Our worst hunt?
Yeah.
I think our worst hunt, well, I mean, on a per shoot, yeah, I mean, do we draw blank a year where we'll kill on a shoot? So a hunt for us, for a group, makes up of five hunts, Monday morning and afternoon, Tuesday morning and afternoon, Wednesday morning. Okay, so that would be your group. Yeah, you might draw a blank on one of those, but it's very, very rare. So if I have two groups at the lodge, our kind of our worst hunt in the last couple of years has been about 360 birds for 10 guys in 2.5 days. So that's our worst hunt. So you're still looking at 36.2 birds per hunter in 2.5 days, right? Pretty strong. But
that's how you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, and, you know, but you have to remember, too, that's what you're paying for. I mean, we've got an army of guides. You know, we're spotting, we're hunting, we kind of know what we're doing. You know, we've got a cook, we've got an assistant, we've got a cleaning lady, we got a bird lady, you see, you know, that. So we don't have to worry about anything. We don't have to worry about going back and picking birds. We don't have to worry about invoicing the hunters. We don't have to worry about giving the hunters ammo. We have one focus, and that's spot, rest, guide, repeat. That's all we do. And we eat and sometimes sneak a shower in every 3 or 4 days in the process. So it's, you know, it's a system that works. And, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, you're working sometimes 16, 18. Sometimes we get 4 hours sleep, 3 hours sleep, and you just power through it. And, you know, and hopefully by Saturday night at 7 o'clock, you get to lay your head down and not worry about anything until Sunday morning, you know. But that's cool. It's fun.
One of the things I like about the show is watching how you and your guides engage with landowners, and that there seem to be really solid relationships there in that area, which I'm sure are a result of 20 plus years of building those. But what advice would you give to someone, and how do you maintain those relationships to make sure that those landowners want you back a second time or call you when there are birds on their property, or how does that look for you guys?
You know, it was hard at first. I mean, you just from being there. I mean, you know, you're there, you know, and I mean, we have a lot of landowners that you just get to know, and some you get along with great, and others that, you know, there's a bunch that don't like us, you know, and that's valid too. But you know, you stop in some days and you have a cocktail with them, you invite them for supper. I mean, of course, you don't get to that stage until you've had a great relationship with them. And, you know, I was 27 when I started, and I'm 53 now. I'll be 54 right away. And, you know, you just get along with people. And, you know, and then some of these guys now, they're, you know, you watch their kids grow up, and we've taken a lot of their kids hunting, you know, because they go, oh, yeah, well, yeah, you can hunt. But, you know, little Johnny was going to go hunting with his buddies. And go, yeah, you know what, why don't we just throw two of them in with us? And then you take them out, and they have this unbelievable hunt. Well, you know, they don't have to worry about any equipment. And then the next time they have, you know, you take them out and you just culture, and, you know, and it's great. Cause I mean, you know, we love to hunt so much, but guides just, you can't afford to hunt every day. It's expensive. Right. So the only difference for us is we don't pull the trigger, and that's not that big of a deal. You know, it's getting the birds to do the dance 15 feet off your client's toes or your toes, or the kid's toes. That's the deal, you know, and it really has nothing to do with the money. It has everything to do with, you know, watching that one snow goose drop its leg a little bit and, you know, as they prepare to land. And then it's those mallards bowed up and those honkers coming in and, you know, and the speckled bellies whiffling at 300 yards they want in so bad. And then you get them to finish at 50 yards. That's the deal. Like, that's what we live for, you know, and no different than a Labrador Retriever. I mean, they're living bred. You throw a bumper, they're going to bring it back, you know, and you take the bumper away and they're sad. And that's the way we are. So it's about that. And that's how we culture some of it, is by, you know, taking some of the landowners and their landowners' friends and landowners' kids hunting. And, but, you know, you don't, you know, it's not done. I mean, I would never culture a relationship, you know, just for the hunting. You culture the relationship because you love the people you're surrounded with, you know?
Do you guys have a lot of problems with people coming in from out of town and destroying property and, you know, not respecting the landowner and stuff like that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, the bird hunting crowd's pretty good. I mean, no, it's pretty good. I mean, you know, the only sad part is, you know, it is the one guy that leaves a mess, you know, that paints the brush for everybody. But, you know, no one spends more time cruising the community than me and, you know, me and the guys. And, you know, you just don't see a lot of junk. You just don't, you know, you never see carcasses laying around. I mean, it's pretty cool. Most people are very respectful. I mean, you know, you clean up all your empties. You know, we use magnets to make sure everything, you know, I mean, if there's so much as a gum wrapper or a cigarette butt, you know what I mean? I don't like leaving anything in the field, you know, and if the wads, you know, we can come by and pick up some of the wads if they're visible and they're, you know, right around us here, we'll pick those up too, you know. But just about keeping things clean and being respectful of the land, and, you know, but we all did that, you know, and most people are pretty good.
Yeah, I guess we have a bit more of a concentration of hunters down here, and so you kind of get that. Or we have a few more of those that go into the fields and leave all their crap and make all of us look bad, you know, and it's frustrating when people do that. But,
well, I think a lot of that is, you know, education too, right? Like, if you really, you know, if you don't think it's a big deal, you're like, wow, it's a couple empties. I mean, they're just going to run over them with the tractor or whatever, you know, but it is a big deal. You know, it'd be like leaving a bunch of trash on a golf green, because that guy's, you know, that farmer's field, that's his golf green. Do you know what I mean? And it really is just education. You never leave a bunch of junk on a golf green. You just would never do that. And, you know, it should translate across. And most people just, I think, don't understand it, or, you know, throwing a few pop cans in the ditch. Well, that is a big deal. Throw them in your truck, get rid of them later, right? It's just a matter of keeping things clean, but.
Throw them in your truck, get rid of them 3 months after season. But I guess that's just how I roll.
Yeah. Yeah, or whatever, you know. I mean, I get in the habit of cleaning up. We just, you know, me and the guides, I just have this mandate, you know, and it spills down. Like, it's like, A, you clean up the field, and then you get back and you clean up your truck. And even if you went spotting, I don't want to hop into your spotting car that I supplied and see so much as a gum wrapper in there. So, you know, and everything, it just flows. Like, we just have this system, and, you know, the guides are all real good. And the guides that don't comply, they just don't stick around. And I've been blessed. You know, Brad's been with me for 20 years. Jason for probably 12. Mel's going on 8 or 9. Jeff's been with us for 7. Daryl's 3 or 4 now. So, I mean, we get along really great. We just have this thing. We're all kind of clean. We're all kind of organized. And, you know, and we make sure that we take care of everything, all the details, you know. And empties in a farmer's field is a big deal. It's a big deal to them, and it's even a bigger deal to us, right? So.
Absolutely, yeah. Shifting gears a little bit, looks like Alberta is actually looking at a crane season again. Do you think that's going to happen, and are you guys going to offer crane hunts if it does?
You know, I probably won't. I mean, our hands are pretty full, and, you know, we see more cranes in the spring than we do in the fall. In the fall, our cranes are all bunched up, you know, half a mile high and just wheeling, catching the thermals flying south. But, you know, and I could literally count on one hand how many times I could have shot cranes in the last 20 years. Like, you know, you get the odd one, just like, whoa, there's one come in. And, you know, but it's just so happenstance. But, I mean, some of the guys in the province, I think, could probably chase them and do fairly well at them. You know, I know Daryl at our Saskatchewan Lodge, I mean, they hunt them hard. It's just another one of their hunts, and most of the clients like it and want to shoot one of their hunts as a crane hunter, sometimes two, you know, in the afternoons. And but I don't know that Alberta or all parts of Alberta would, you know, necessarily chase them hard. And a lot of it's a cultural thing, right? Like, I mean, even if you opened up swans in Alberta, you haven't been able to hunt swans in Alberta historically, and I don't know that a whole bunch of people would just go out and chase them. You know, I don't think they would, but it's just my thought. So,
but. Almost like it's like counter to the way that we've been like bred to think over time.
Yeah, you know, it's like the snow goose thing, right? Like, you could always have hunted snow geese, and then, you know, when they brought on the electronic collars and they kind of gave us the tools and the numbers went up a little bit more, it became, you know, there was a handful of us really only chasing them, you know, and now it's like it's the thing to do. Right, the snow geese are the thing to chase and the thing to do. So, I mean, it could change, you know, but I'm not sure. I don't know how much it would change, really, to be honest with you. But that's just me, right? That's just because I don't have the opportunity to chase them, and I don't think we would.
So, speaking of snow geese, this new clothing line that you came out with, or that you're coming out with. Where you're dressed up like a snow goose, basically. Tell us about that.
Well, so, you know, we hunt out of, you know, the Cabela's layout blinds a lot, and uprights. And then, you know, there are times when, you know, hunting out of a white suit in the snow goose rig is more conducive than sometimes being in a layout blind. And, you know, so it gives, you know, a little bit more mobility. So we've been hunting out of the white suits for, you know, since before we had the TV show. And it seems to work. And then, you know, of course, I look at us. We're running around wearing these fluffy white suits. I go, we kind of look like dorks, you know. And one of the reasons. And the other reason, we thought, okay, so, I mean, if the white suits work, looking more like a snow goose top and bottom, we might break up even a little bit better. I mean, because we analyze every detail, right? Like, when we go on a hunt, me and the guides have meetings every day, twice a day, and, you know, we discuss pre-hunt and post-hunt, what we did, what we could have done different, and then we'll send up a drone, we'll analyze the spread, we'll analyze what we look like in the spread. And when you put on the white suits, you look like five guys laying in the white suits, right? And I thought, okay, so are some of the birds bouncing off of that? Or, you know, the ones that do it, obviously it's effective. You know, and so are the layout blinds, right? And but sometimes they bounce off the layout blinds given the light and the conditions as well. So there's no one tool that you can always use. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna try. We decided, hey, it would be cool if we had a bit of a feather pattern on the topic. So I went, well, that should be easy enough. And, you know, I kind of barked up that tree for a little while. And then I just started playing around with, you know, my ability with, you know, Adobe Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator, which is some of the stuff I taught in the past. And I was missing a few links. So I took a $1,000 course in Adobe Illustrator. And then I could really dabble and put the tools together. And I thought, well, that looks kind of cool. Let's get a couple of them printed. And then we went out and hunted and whacked a bunch of birds. So it's not, will it work any better? But it's not that it doesn't work. Did it help us on a couple of days? Yeah, it did. So, I mean, if you know, and that's just kind of the way it shook down. And I've got one that no one's seen yet. And it's, you know, it looks like the snow goose hoodie, but it's out of for speckle bellies and for Canada geese. So we'll know more in the fall. There's a product I developed back in late 94, early 1995 called the goose chair. And what it was is just like a low reclining chair with a goose decoy on it. And we shot thousands of geese out of those things and mallards. We just hide underneath them. We'd flick the goose chair, you know, lit up. And then, of course, you fast forward 25 years and we have, you know, different technology where you can actually, you know, full color print clothing. You know, you dream it, you can print it and produce it. I went, wow, well, why have this big decoy on there when you could kind of just look like one right at a lower level? And that's where kind of that spawned from. So here we are.
So have you just used it on snow so far, or have you used it on specs as well?
Just from snows so far. But I know based on the way we kill a lot of our speckle bellies, if you watch a show, you'll see us a lot of times we're in a snow rig hunting specks. And, you know, we'll do that even before the snow geese are here because the snow geese will relate to the specks. So, I mean, imagine, you know, hunting with 500 speck decoys, a handful of white ones to light you up in the field, and now you're sitting in and you're kind of in your goose rig. Instead of trying to look like the dirt, you actually look like a bird, you know, and we'll see. I mean, you know, it could be a game changer, and it may not be. I mean, time will tell, right? We'll see what happens, I guess. But they look cool.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I guess the thing is, when you with camo patterns and stuff, you're dealing with a generic camo pattern that's never going to perfectly fit whatever vegetation you're hunting. But
right,
the birds will always look the same. So if you can pull that look off, I mean, there's a lot of potential.
Right. You know, and what I did with the pants is, you know, I came up with a basically I'm calling it prairie stubble. I mean, this is so early in the stages, but, you know, basically I went and I'm just matching prairie stubble, and you can't just take a photograph and print it. I mean, you can, but it won't look right. So you have to get, you know, the way to get that crisp image. I mean, I was taking it in Photoshop, manipulating it there, manipulating it in Adobe Illustrator, blending it all, and then you output this file that, you know, you got to get color proof to make sure it looks good. And then you got to take that printed version and drop it in the field and see if it looks good. My first one was a little bit too golden. My second one was just a little bit too light. I went a little too far. And now I've got it right where it's just perfect. You throw that in a wheat or a barley field, and, I mean, you can hardly see it, you know, which is pretty cool. That's the camel part. And then, you know, I put some, you know, from the knee down, we would wear kind of whites on the bottom from the knee down once in a while. But anyways, I thought, well, let's print on the shin part of your pant, like the top view of a goose. And I don't even have the head on there. It's just basically a blob of white that looks like a goose. And, you know, when you look at the drone footage, you don't look like this total human laying there, because you're broken up into, you had camel on your thighs and, you know, and a goose on your shins, and your upper body's a goose, and, you know, and then I've got another one that no one's seen yet, where it's, you know, there's a goose decoy or a goose printed on across the chest. So if your camel matches perfectly, you know, it's just all a matter of concealment. You still have to use your other assets, like, you know, longer stakes on the silosox to cover you up and get them close, or, you know, but it's just another tool. Given the right conditions, it will work, you know, and you know, there's times that we have to be in upright blinds, you know, because we have a feeling that that'll work better. And, you know, and I'm always battling with, you know, there's also client comfort. Like, it's different if you or I go out and, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, coming out of a low down, laying down chair shooting. But I have hunters now that started with us. They were in their 60s and now they're in their mid 80s. They go, Claudio, we don't want to lay down anymore. So then this whole clothing concept for them won't work, but it's not designed for them. We have to put them in an upright blind, whether it's on the edge of a field or whatever. We have to manipulate the situation so we make it work for them. And, you know, some days we'll be cutting a bunch of willows and spruce browse to hunt. So it's just a tool in the arsenal, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the way to look at any waterfowl tool with a game that's as finicky as ducks and geese are. I mean, I talk to people all the time that say, you know, I mean, a simple question like, what decoys do you recommend? Well, I don't know. What's your situation? You know, the situation changes from day to day. There's nothing I can sell you that's going to be the perfect item that's going to change your hunting world, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Like, there's no one game changer, but when you have all of the game changers at your disposal, that's when you become successful every day.
Starting with some scouting and birds.
Yeah, like for example, I mean, this is something that may, you know, most guys may not realize, but, you know, I do not like an east wind in the morning and a west wind in the evening. I don't like the sun behind us. And everyone likes that because they don't have to look into the sun, but I think your spread looks better when it's front lit instead of back lit. So, and there's not a full body in the world, unless it's fully flocked, that won't deliver a little bit of glare, right? And it's that bounce coming from the sun off the decoy back up. And you can see it. I mean, you can see it with your eyes. Put a drone up a little higher, you just get a different level of reflection, because that's what the birds see. Whereas when the sun is at the bird's back and it's in your eyes, I find we always do better that way, because it's, the decoys are lit up properly. It looks better to me. And I just find I'd rather hunt them that way than have the birds approach, you know, with the sun in front of them, where you're getting the bounce off, you know, you shine off everything, you know, shine off the hull, shine off the shotgun, shine off anything that potentially can emit some glare, will happen, you know, with an east wind in the morning and a west wind in the evening. Anytime they got to approach facing the sun, I just, you know, causes some issues. That's for me. That's just the way I look at it. But
that's interesting. I don't think I've ever heard somebody say that, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I could, you know, I can tell you I've hunted, you know, like, I don't know how many hunts I've done, but lots, you know, and I just, you know what, you go out and, you know, you got your full bodies out and you've got a west wind on the evening hunt and they're not fully flocked. And, you know, and let's face it, you can't keep all your decoys perfectly flat all the time. I know in our business we can, just we use the gear so much. So, you know, I ended up going with Avery FFDs, you know, the fully flocked decoys, and those were a game changer because there was no glare coming off of those. So you could hunt, you know, with the wind, obviously the wind at your back and the sun at your back, and not having bounce any glare at all. So, and that's where I referred to, you know, everything can be a game changer under every situation, but you got to be able to have access to all of your game changer technology all the time. And I get it. It's hard. You know, you got to have a whole bunch of money to inject in equipment. You have to have a wife or girlfriend who's very understanding, and you have to have a place to store all this stuff, right? So, you know, as an outfitter, you're in a slightly different situation because you just have to buy the tools and you just store them, and then you throw some away when they don't work anymore, and you just inject and you buy more. But it's just, you know, it's all game-changing technology if you use it right. You know?
What has been the biggest game changer for you as far as equipment? I know you don't like to really push product, but what's the tool in your arsenal that you feel like has made the biggest difference?
Again, there's a whole bunch of them. If to pick one, this might seem like a real off thing, but we always present clients with birds in front of them, right? Probably one of the two biggest game changers would probably be the guns. I mean, the Benellis are strong because they do pop every time you pull the trigger. And probably the biggest, believe it or not, I would say is the heavy shot ammo. It's just, you know, you can't deny when you've got a group of hunters shooting, you know, less than premium ammo, and then you put a bunch of premium ammo in their hands. And then, you know, and I can relate, one comment, Jeff came back probably the second time, you know, he guided a bunch of guys. We started shooting the heavy shot stuff. You know, it was heavy steel. But he goes, that stuff's good. He goes, I didn't ring many necks today. And that's good. You know what I mean? So when you've got, you know, you're throwing the right stones at these things, and now they're falling, and they're falling hard, that to me is a big advantage. You know, because we always do our job. We will always have the tools to decoy them. But some days when you don't and they're slipping at 35 yards and the clients are still dumping them, to me, that's pretty big. You know, fast, hard-hitting, well-patterning ammo is very important. And I overlooked that for years. You know, But when you see a 20 or 30% jump in your kill rate and nothing else has changed, that's pretty strong, you know.
So yeah, it makes for a better hunt when you're not chasing triples all day, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, and you know, I mean, if everyone could afford to shoot, you know, the heavy shot or the, you know, the speedball, I mean, all the time, well, our kill would even go up a little higher. You know what I mean? But, you know, you got to weigh out the affordability as well. But, you know, the heavy steel, that stuff's unbelievable. And the heavy hammer now, like I was shooting it just, you know, this spring with the snow geese, it hits hard. I mean, and I can tell when you dust the bird, it folds up and its neck goes limp the minute the shot goes through it, you know, and that's at 45 or 55 yards. You know, the shot's doing its job, whereas, you know, something other than that, you know, a lot of times you hear the bird will sail off. And how many birds sail off instead of 300 yards? They sail off a mile away and you know, you see this white little fluff ball floating on a roost 2 miles away. Well, it came from somewhere, right? So, but
yeah,
so
absolutely.
I mean, I you know, but it all has to come together. You know, the spotting, the gear, the equipment, the decoys. I mean, you know, some days we'll use full body, some days we'll use silo socks, and you know what works for us. Like I have a buddy of mine who's an outfitter. He started shooting, you know, his Canada's over silo socks, and that's all he does. He puts 225 silo socks. He hasn't put on a full body in 2 years. And, you know, we just don't have the confidence for the Canadas yet, you know, so we're still using full bodies and mix in some silo socks, or sometimes we don't, but our spec snow goose rig is exclusively silo socks. So, you know, it's what works. But the one big thing for us, like I said, I think would have to be the ammunition. You know, just because I've seen the numbers and, you know, we see what comes back and you get the comments from the clients going, wow, you know, when we hit them, they fall, which is big, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so let's talk about scouting. You guys obviously put in a ton of work. You've got everybody on the road every day looking for hunts. And sometimes the birds just don't show back up like you kind of talked about earlier. What are you looking for when you're watching a field or puddle? Because you guys sit on them all evening or all morning, correct? Until they leave.
Well, you don't have to, but if you don't, there's a lot of variables that, you know, could go sideways, right? I mean, that's where I think most people fail. And, well, first of all, you said, you know, sometimes they don't come back. Let me rephrase that. Most of the times, they don't come back. And that's why spotting is so critical, right? So if we're watching 10 pods, 7 of them might not go back to the same place twice. But it's when they go back the second time, we try to kill them on the third time. So, you know, contrary to, you know, people think, oh, yeah, you're tying up all the hunts and you're watching for 10 days. Man, 10 days in our world is like 100 years to a dog. You know what I mean? Like you watch them. So what we're scouting for is the repeatability of what the birds are doing. That's it. And all we're doing is getting in their way. And we're getting in there with a bunch of decoys and hopefully funneling them, you know, within 15 yards of our hunters, right? But that's what we're looking for is the birds doing the same thing twice, and then you try to hit them on the third time, right? I mean, and sometimes you only have the luxury where if we're scambling and, you know, when I said 8 of those or 7 of those 10 went sideways, well, what happens when 10 of them, 10 out of 10 goes sideways? You pick the last pod that you saw feeding placidly and they leave on their own and you hope to get underneath them. But those seem to be the times where we do come up short, you know, when you don't have all the intel on them or you're backlogged a little bit. So that'd be the biggest thing, you know. And of course, you know, a lot of guys don't have the time, right? So, you know, you've got Friday off of work and you leave the city, you go spotting on Thursday night, you find a pot of birds, you get permission on it, and you hunt it the next day. Well, there's a good chance they may not come back. You know, and that's why we're so paranoid all the time, because we see how many don't come back versus how many do come back. You know, so you kind of, for lack of a better word, pucker up every time you go hunting. You know? We do.
Yeah, I mean, the stakes are a little bit lower for one of us that's just going out with a few friends or something like that versus you guys that are under that kind of pressure to somehow corral those wild animals into your decoys.
Yeah, you know, and again, if we can do our job, and, you know, and that's why, you know, we got a spotting team and a guiding team, and that swaps back and forth. I mean, you're either spotting or guiding, you know, and none of us like to hunt a hunt that we haven't spotted. And we will do it rarely. Like, you know, let's say I haven't done a snow goose hunt in a while, and Brad or Mel, you know, has done 4 or 5 in a row. I go, hey, I'd love to do one, but I'll go, you know what? Yeah, why don't you come do this hunt? And I'll go in on it. And I trust Brad because, I mean, I trust him every day with clients. Why wouldn't I trust them to put me in on a guided hunt, right? So that, you know, that's how we do it. But but otherwise, we like to all spot our own hunts, because we're just eternally paranoid about the stuff that can go wrong, because, you know, they don't have to come back, you know. And sometimes the clients will go, are they going to come back? I go, I'll tell you in an hour, you know. Like, I don't know, they might not come back, you know. And they certainly don't have to come back if they don't want to. That's the thing, you know.
But yeah, and you have no idea what's going on the back end.
No idea. And, you know, sometimes they just move. You know, they just do it on their own. Or they, you know, they went back to roost somewhere different than it was, and they ended up roosting in a pea field. And then all of a sudden, you know, 3 of them walk out to, you know, grab a little bit of grit, and they walk another 3 feet to roost in the stubble, and all of a sudden there's all these peas around, and then next thing you know it, everything walks out and feeds in the peas, and they don't fly to where you're hunting in a barley stubble field 4 miles away. Just go, oops. And the reason we know stuff like that happens is because, you know, either you have another guy on the ground going, texting, goes, oh boy, you're screwed, right? Or your pot of birds is doing something else. Or the next day you go out and spot, and you go, oh, well, that's where they are now. Interesting, you know, but... Fun. That's what keeps on our toes.
I'm sure that keeps it interesting over 20 years. I mean, you've been running out of time, but real quick, you've been involved with these birds for half of your life, as a guide, and probably longer than that. what do you see as far as like changing migration patterns or populations? Do you feel like things are healthy and you're kind of close to the top of the flyway? What do you see up there?
I monitor that carefully. I mean, you know, we've certainly seen, of course, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, this isn't a, you know, being a very bold statement, but we've definitely seen the snow geese multiply to the point where there's too many, and that's why all the conservation measures. So have I noticed that? Oh, yeah, I have. You know, we used to see 5,000 geese. Now we'll see more than 5,000 whites on any given day, right? And you know, you hear rumors that, you know, or the science behind the migration shifting further west. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't have anything to document that. Have spec numbers gone up a little bit? Yeah, I believe they have, and believe there's, you know, data to document that, and so has the Canada's. You know, they've increased. And I do know one thing, though. I mean, if we have a lot of snow and good breeding conditions, there's a lot more ducks and geese around. And, you know, if we go through a drought like we did, you know, 99 to 02, you know, there's not a lot of ducks around. And, you know, that's not good. So habitat and moisture is huge, you know, and the more wetlands we have, the better it is, for sure.
Especially in the breeding areas.
Yeah, you know, and you know, and I do believe that the breeding areas are expanding, you know, and I think with modern agriculture, you know, you go back 150 years, there was not nearly as much food on the prairies for waterfowl as there are now. I mean, the waste grain component is, just imagine the millions and millions and millions of bushels that just don't get picked up by the combines, right? So, I mean, all that on the ground, whereas, you know, go back 200 years ago, which might seem a long time for us, but in the history of the world, you know, the mallards and the snow geese, they've been flying back and forth a long time, and they didn't have access to that high-quality food. So, you know, survival rates are higher, you know, the migration's different. I would imagine if the hops are smaller, you know, for, you know, why would you fly 300 miles on a flight where you could just fly 40 miles, find another pot of birds with a bunch of food and plop down? And, you know, I don't know how they migrate, but I'd imagine it's different than it would have been from 200 years ago, you know?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, lots changed for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, this has been awesome. It feels like it's gone by really fast, but we've been talking for close to an hour already.
What?
But that's how waterfowl conversations go.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to book a hunt with you or wants to find your show, where can they find you?
You know, on garrows.com is kind of the central place. And then, you know, if you just type in hired to hunt on YouTube, you'll see it there. And we're uploading that Prime Video, so hopefully that goes. And, yeah, just, you know, check in once in a while. I'm not, I do some social media stuff and I try to stay as active as I can, but you know, when, you know, it's a one man show, me and Angela are trying to, you know, run everything and it gets busy. So it's just, you know, and then, you know, it's one of those deals where, you know, you dial that 1-800 number on my website and it goes right to my cell phone. So you're not going to get, you're not going to get a big long winded message on how to communicate with us. You're going to get me going, hello. That's how we still kind of roll that way. We believe in answering the phones best we can, you know. In fact, the only message you will hear if I don't pick up says, don't leave a message. Shoot me a text and I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
You are quick to get back to messages. On garrows.com, we'll link to that in the description wherever this is posted, and then also the Hired to Hunt channel on YouTube. You upload all your episodes to YouTube, correct?
We do. Once they've been aired, like right now we're just about done editing season 6. And of course, once they air by the end of October, once they air in Q3, then we can throw them up on YouTube. So starting November, we'll start putting up season 6.
Mm-hmm. They're on the Pursuit channel?
I'm not sure. Right now it's on Wild TV in Canada and for this year anyways, and possibly 2021, we may be looking at the Pursuit channel or doing something over there as well.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we will, we'll link to everything in the description here. Claudio Ongaro, the owner of Ongaro's Outdoor Outfitters in Alberta and now Saskatchewan. this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us. And we really appreciate it and looking forward to the new episodes coming out, and wish you a successful rest of the snowview season.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It was all my pleasure. Anytime I can talk waterfowl is a great day. Take me on that and listen.
Same here. We'll have to do it again. This is the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast.